Please join me in 2 Kings chapter number 7, where we had to break off yesterday in the middle of a story about Elisha the prophet. Elisha is in the city of Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, during a time of great famine. The city is under siege by the Syrian forces of Ben-Hadad, and people are starving. They are paying exorbitant amounts of money for scraps of food they're not even kosher, and trying to make the most out of any fuel sources that they can scrape together. And the king is horrified by reports of cannibalism inside the capital. And he, instead of repenting of the sins which have brought this judgment upon his land, he is infuriated that God would allow such things to happen, and he wants to track down and kill the prophet Elisha. And so Elisha has been made aware of this, and he's told the elders of the city, perhaps the elders of the country that are with him, to not let the messenger of King Jehoram through the door when he arrives. And they don't. And so Elisha is able to respond to the accusations of King Jehoram that this is all God's fault. It's all because God can't or won't provide the security that the Israeli people need. And so Elisha is commissioned by God to give an unquestionable miracle from He who is. So 2 Kings chapter number 7, Elisha said, remember, he's saying this in the presence of the leaders of northern Israel, "Hear the word of He who is. Thus says He who is, tomorrow at this time," so very precise, this hour of the day, "a seah of fine flour," and that's just a measurement, roughly 7 quarts, think about 3.5 2-quart bottles of pop, that size of a container. So seven and a half quarts or 7.5 liters of fine wheat flour shall be sold for a shekel. So a shekel is roughly 2 days' wages. We'd think that that was pretty expensive for the flour needed to produce 20 or maybe 25 pound loaves of bread, but we're talking about high-grade bread. And 2 seahs, so twice that amount of barley flour for a shekel. So this is pretty common ratio that wheat flour is twice as expensive as barley flour. This amount of flour is going to be available at these sorts of prices at the gate of Samaria 24 hours later. Now remember, they're in a famine. There is no flour anywhere inside the city of Samaria. That's all been used up long ago. And so the captain on whose hand the king leaned, so this would be his right-hand military guy, said to the man of God, "If He who is Himself should make windows in heaven, could this thing be?" What he means here is, even if God started it raining right this moment, how in the world are we going to end up with that much flour? We can't plant and grow and harvest and grind up enough grain to make what you say happened by tomorrow at this time. But Elisha said, "You're going to see it with your own eyes, but you're not going to eat of it." And so this is a prophetic demonstration of foreknowledge, that Elisha knows exactly what's going to be available tomorrow at this time, and that this man that's expressing his unbelief will see it, but won't get a chance to eat it. So very precise prophecies. Verse number 3. Now, there were 4 men who were lepers at the entrance to the gate. Now let's talk about leprosy again. Leprosy is not Hansen's disease. I'm trying to eradicate that belief. It's not accurate. Biblical leprosy is a mark, a supernatural mark of God placed on certain people's places or things to indicate the need of evaluation, and in the case of the people, a need for change and the ability to change for the person. So these lepers at some point in the past have been marked by God that they need to change their lives, change the actions. Now, the Jewish law of Moses regarding leprosy was, if you didn't change, you were isolated from society. You had to go and live away from society until you were ready to change and God could take the mark off you. So a lot of times these lepers would hang out with one another in order to alleviate some of the burden, the social burden of being alone. So these 4 lepers have set up a place near the entrance of the gate of Samaria where they could beg for alms at a distance because they can't have a normal job. They have to depend upon people, you know, throwing them scraps of supplies and coins. So they said to one another, why are we sitting here until we die? If we say, let us enter the city, the famine is in the city, and we're just going to die there. And if we sit here, we also die. So now, come, let us go over to the camp of the Syrians. If they spare our lives, we shall live. If they kill us, we shall but die. So they are between a rock and a hard place, as we'd say. If they beg the people of Samaria to let them in the town, that's not going to do them any good because there's no food in there. So they're going to starve to death. If they just sit by the gates, there's no people coming in and out of these gates to feed them or give them supplies so that they can somehow figure out a way to buy supplies, and there are no supplies to buy. So they'll starve if they sit by the gate. So they come up with a conclusion, we've got to at least try something with the Syrians. Maybe if we go over to them, they'll have pity on us. If they don't, what's the worst thing that can happen? We'll die, which is what's going to happen to us if we just sit here. Verse 5. So they arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Syrians. Now, twilight here seems to indicate that time between mid-afternoon and when the sun goes down, and after the sun's gone down, it starts getting darker. So sometime in the evening hours, the afternoon and early evening hours. So they head over there, but when they came to the edge of the camp of the Syrians, behold, there was no one there. So they've come to the siege camp, which is going to be farther away because they don't need to be right up on top of Samaria. All they have to do is just cut off supplies from getting into them. So they get to the camp, and the camp is empty. And then we get a backstory, verse 6. For the Lord, that is He who is, had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, oh, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to come up against us. So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents, their horses, their donkeys, leaving the camp as it was, and fled for their lives. So sometime earlier that day, before these lepers arrive. The Syrian army, which most of them are just sitting around waiting, because that's what they're doing. They're waiting out the starvation effects against the Israelis. So they're probably sitting around, chewing the fat, eating, drinking, playing games. And suddenly they hear, echoing off of the hillsides around them, what sounds to them like a huge army, including fast-moving chariots. They can't see it, but they hear it. And it throws them into a blind panic, because now they are convinced, and God no doubt also puts this into their hearts, they are convinced that somehow the king of Israel, Jehoram, has got a message through the barricades and hired the mercenaries out of Egypt, or the mercenaries from way up north amongst the Hittite peoples, to come and attack the Syrians. And both of these forces are very, very formidable. And so the Syrians are panicked, and they don't even try to pack up their camps. They are positive that if they don't run away now, they will die. So they leave everything where it was. All the food supplies, all the military supplies, their own horses, the pack animals, their clothing, their tents, everything is just left in place. They've probably been cooking, and so the food is just right there in the pots and just waiting. And then they take off. They're gone. They're long gone by the time these lepers get there. So verse 8, when these lepers, remember there's four of them, when these lepers came to the edge of the camp, they went into a tent, and they ate and they drank. So they come into the encampment, and they don't see anybody around, and they go into one of the tents, and they see food on the table, all ready to go. So they eat it, because they're starving, they're hungry, and they're drinking the wine that was probably sitting there on the table as well. And then they carried off silver and gold and clothing, and they went and hid them. So they see the wealth, the riches that are here, and they start packing what they can carry out of the encampment, hiding it somewhere where they can retrieve it later. And then they came back and they entered another tent, and they carried off things from it, and they went and hid them. So they're only thinking about their own future. We need supplies that we can live off of for as long as we are set outside of society. So we will gather as much as we can hide and guarantee that we'll never have to beg. Well, eventually though, after this process has gone on for a little while, they started thinking about things. Verse 9, then they said to one another, "We're not doing right. This day is a day of good news. If we're silent and we wait until the morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now, therefore, let us go and tell the king's household." So eventually, their loyalty to the Israeli nation as a whole overtakes their own personal greed or self-serving attitude. And they think, you know what? This is too good a news to keep to ourselves. Our Israeli compatriots, they need to know about this. The king needs to know that there's not an army out here anymore keeping them barricaded in, and that there's supplies everywhere here. So verse 10, they came and they called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, "We came to the camp of the Syrians, and behold, there's no one to be seen or heard there. Nothing but the horses tied and the donkeys tied and the tents as they are." So they report the situation to the watchman. Then the gatekeepers called out, and it was told within the king's household. So by now, it's early morning hours, probably. It's still dark. So the king rose in the night, and he said to his servants, I will tell you what the Syrians have done to us. They know that we're hungry. Therefore, they've gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the open country, thinking, when we come out of the city, we shall take them alive and get into the city. So, Jehoram of northern Israel assumes that this is a plot to get them to open the gates and come out so that the Syrians can then ambush them and end the siege by capturing the city. Well, verse 13, one of his servants said, let us take men, maybe five of the remaining horses, and seeing that those who are left here will fare like the whole multitude of Israel who have already perished, let us send and see. So he suggests, let us just take a few people, a representative sample, to go out there and check on the story. That way, if it does turn out to be an ambush, then only those guys are put at risk. Well, the king only allows them to take two of the remaining five horses. So they took two horsemen, and the king sent them after the army of the Syrians, saying, go and see. So his instructions are, you go out there and check on the situation. If you can't find the Syrian army, you track them down. You find out where they're at. Verse 15, so they went after them as far as the Jordan. Now, the Jordan is a good day's ride over and back from Samaria. So these two horsemen track the Syrian army, the routed Syrian army, all the way to the Jordan River where they crossed and were still heading away. So they know they're not a threat anymore. So they went as far as the Jordan. Behold, all the way was littered with garments and equipment that the Syrians had thrown away in their haste. And then the messengers returned and told the king. So this is all real panic that these guys are going to report on. When armies think that they are being pursued, that they might be killed, they start stripping themselves of everything of value. They throw off their armor, they throw off their outer clothing, they drop anything extra that they might have been carrying. They basically strip themselves down to a basic civilian. And the hope is that the pursuing army will just be glad to pick up the things that were left behind and leave them alone because they're not a threat anymore. So these messengers come back to the king and let him know, yeah, they're gone. The encampment is there for the taking. And so the people went out and plundered the camp of the Syrians, so that a seah of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel, according to the word of he who is. So exactly as God's prophet Elisha said 24 hours earlier, there, the market by the gate of the city of Samaria is now selling all of this recovered supply for the exact price that the prophet said. And so the king had appointed the captain on whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate, and the people trampled him in the gate so that he died, as the man of God had said when the king came down to him. For when the man of God had said to the king, two seahs of barley shall be sold for a shekel, and a seah of flour, fine flour for a shekel, that's two shekels for the barley, by the way, about this time tomorrow in the gate of Samaria, the captain had answered the man of God, if he who is should make the windows of heaven open up, could this be such a thing be? And he'd said, you'll see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat it. And so it happened to him, for the people trampled him in the gate, and he died. So the very guy that had talked about this being impossible, the king had put in charge of distributing or selling off all of this recovered material. And there was a food stampede of all the hungry people, and he was killed in that stampede. exactly as Elisha had predicted. Which now brings us to the next story in 2 Kings chapter 8 that I want to hold off for just a little bit longer, because we've got some other things that we need to take care of. And these things require us to go over to 2 Chronicles 21. 2 Chronicles 21, 18, to be precise, where we are reminded of something I've talked about before. And that is, after all this, he who has struck him in his bowels with an incurable disease. Now, the him in this context is Jehoram of Judah. Jehoram of Judah, who is the brother-in-law of the king of northern Israel. He's married to the sister of Jehoram of Israel, Athaliah by name. And he was a wicked man, this Jehoram of Judah. And so God has had enough of him, and he ends up having some sort of disease of his gut. And we don't know all the details of this, all except for the fact that he was in a lot of pain for about 2 years, and then he dies. So verse number 19, in course of time, at the end of 2 years, his bowels came out because of the disease, and he died in great agony. And I assigned the date, the year of his death, as being 852 BC. And so his people made no great fire in his honor, like the fires made for his fathers. So he is such a rotten person that the people of southern Judah are just glad he's gone. And they don't even want to have a big ceremony celebrating his reign. Instead, they just want to move on. Now, he was 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 8 years in Jerusalem. So he's only 40 when he dies. And he departed with no one's regret. And they buried him in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. So they've got such disregard for him that he's not even put in the royal graveyard. Then we read this, chapter 22 of 2 Chronicles. The inhabitants of Jerusalem made Ahaziah, his youngest son, king in his place, for the band of men that came with the Arabians to the camp had killed all the older sons. Now, you remember that story. God, in his judgment against Jehoram of Judah, had allowed invaders to come into the country, and these invaders specifically targeted the royal family. And they'd kidnapped and killed the heirs to the throne, with the exception of this one kid that was sticking around with mom and dad in Jerusalem, safe and secure there. Well, now dad's dead, and there's only this one guy left. And he's 22 years of age. That's what we're going to find out in a moment. And he's got a young son himself. So, Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, reigned. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. So he's not going to live very long after his ascension to the throne. In fact, he will be assassinated, as we will see. His mother's name was Athaliah, the granddaughter of Omri. Now, the reason Omri is mentioned here is because he is a significant king of northern Israel as far as the people of the Middle East are concerned. He was the founder of the Omri dynasty. We are more in tune, though, with Omri's son and the father of Athaliah. His name is Ahab, the late Ahab. And, of course, Athaliah's mom would be Jezebel, who's still alive up in the northern kingdom. Well, let's talk a little bit more about this new king in southern Judah. Verse number 3. He also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor in doing wickedly. So Athaliah, the princess of the northern kingdom of Israel, who has now become, through her marriage to Jehoram of southern Judah, the queen of southern Judah, she has brought with her the infection of the worship of Baal and Asherah to the southern kingdom. And she has raised this Ahaziah to worship Baal and Asherah. And so he ends up doing evil in the sight of He Who Is, as the house of Ahab had done. So both kingdoms are now in the grips of this pagan disease of Baal and Asherah worship. And it's all because of a poor choice of a good king that we've said goodbye to not too long ago. That'd be King Jehoshaphat, who allowed his son, Jehoram, to marry the princess daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. And this is one of those things that should teach us the importance of following Scripture when it says that we should not be unequally yoked one with another. We should always keep our intimate relationships balanced with full worship of the one and true living God.